Hi everyone, and welcome to Dr. Dark After Dark number 43 with Callum Thomas on entrepreneurship and also macro. So Callum is the founder of Top Down Charts, and he's a very well-known macro commentator on Fintuit. And so his handle there is at Callum_Thomas. Callum is a New Zealander, and many regular listeners will know, my wife and my kids are also New Zealanders. He left his corporate job in 2016 to start Top Down Charts. And so they serve fund managers and investors across the globe with macro research. So he's in New Zealand, so Callum must be in Auckland, right? I mean, it's probably the only city most people here have heard of. But he's not. He's actually 45 degrees south. Well, he was. Now he's even further south than that. So that's level with somewhere like Patagonia in Chile or Argentina. So this is a long way south. Keep going south and before you know it, you're in Antarctica. So in true New Zealand style, this is totally unscripted, and I'm sure that she'll be all right. That's a very bad joke. If you hear a yeah, nah at any point, that probably means no, but it might not. If you're confused, you should be. So as always, it's not investment advice. Please do your own research. Callum, welcome. How are you doing?
Yes, very well. That's yeah, the old yeah, nah. It's a good old Kiwi.
And you can
Kiwiism,
do a,
that one, and
you can do a nah, yeah. No, it's a yeah, nah, yeah. Yeah, nah, yeah.
Doesn't really roll off the tongue. Yeah.
Yeah. No, yeah.
But actually, to pick up on one of that, one of those comments is, so as far as I know, I'm the world's southernmost investment research firm, unless there's anyone, down in Patagonia or Stewart Island.
Stewart Island would be further south, and Antarctica, and somewhere right at the tip of Chile.
Yep.
That's pretty cool.
Exactly.
All right, well, why don't we start with some background on yourself? You know, a lot of listeners are very interested in entrepreneurship. You know, so what did you study? What was your kind of career path before you kind of took the plunge?
Yes, good question. I started studying, go back in the memory banks for this. So I'd started studying a certificate in business at the Southern Institute of Technology. That was, I don't remember what year that was, but that was so after leaving high school, I did all of New Zealand high school and then worked in the sawmill. So my dad owned a sawmill in a small town called Otautau. So I worked in the sawmill for, I think, about 6 months, at least 6 months. And so that was just, you know, hard labor. Because at the time I'd started investing, you know, a couple of years earlier, and, I wasn't entirely convinced that going straight to university was necessarily the best idea. I was sort of fixated on basically just getting more money to invest in the share market. And so when I was sitting there playing computer games and Dad asked me if I wanted a job, I said, oh, yeah, sure. But I did get sick of getting sawdust in my eyes and splinters in my fingers, so I decided to move from Otautau to the big city of Invercargill. And
the listeners, how big is Invercargill population-wise?
Invercargill, I'd have to look that up. I think it's about 50,000 people.
Yeah, it's about that. So it's a decent-sized town. If someone's listening and say,
Yeah, it's like maybe a second or third tier city in New Zealand context. Yeah, but so after that, job stacking shelves at the supermarket and studying part time at the Southern Institute Certificate of Business, which was just general business stuff. Then I moved on from that to a diploma in business, and then figured that I was sort of just meandering at that point, and then I just thought, maybe I'll go into financial planning. And so I started studying a financial planning diploma extramurally via Massey. And then as I got into that, I was like, maybe I'll do finance. Maybe I'll, become a fund manager or investment banker or something. And so I started, rolled that all into a Bachelor's of Business and Finance at Massey, and actually went on campus for the last year of that. So I figured, and that was the Albany campus in Auckland. So I figured, Auckland's where all the jobs will probably be, so I may as well go up there. And within a couple of weeks of moving there, I got a part-time job at a finance company doing consumer lending, which was very interesting and a very good way to sort of build your confidence up as people, as soon as you declined a loan, people would, half the time they'd call up and demand to know why. And so that was pretty good. But then after that, I ended up getting a job at the New Zealand Stock Exchange, which was in Wellington. So moved to Auckland thinking that I'd get a job there, ended up getting my first full-time job at NZX in Wellington. So it's the New Zealand Stock Exchange. And that was a bit of all sorts. So, I guess it was a combination of corporate strategy, management consulting type work, investment banking, mergers and acquisitions type work, a bit of market analysis, pricing analysis. Really good way of getting exposure to a lot of different things, which helped me figure out, one, what I did like, which was the market side of things, and what I didn't like, which is actually the investment banking side of things. I kind of thought that I was going to do that, given the nice salaries that you could earn there, but then I realized that I didn't like it. So that's a little piece of advice there. If you're figuring out what you want to do, is try a lot of things. So after that, I did that for just over a year. It was quite a high pressure work environment, and I was working pretty much directly with the CEO there, who was kind of one of those no BS guys, and even got a little bit of a chewing out one time, which is a really good thing for coming fresh out of university, because university, you sort of get this false sense of security that you know something because you've done exams and gotten these good grades. But then you realize in that kind of situation that actually you don't know much at all, and you better sharpen up. So it was maybe not an enjoyable experience as such, but a really good experience. And then after that, I should rewind a little bit. When I was in university, I started a website, a small cap research website, equity research website. And, because I figured maybe I'd end up going into that. And that was actually the thing that helped get me the job at NZX. But ultimately, they made me sell that before I joined, because it was actually in competition to one of the businesses that they had. So where were we? And after that,
you kind of sold your first company, as it were, before you got your first proper job in some ways. I mean, I'm sure this wasn't a transaction, but it's pretty cool.
It was about 5,000 New Zealand dollars. So,
well, that's a lot of money. So, yeah.
Well, the first salary was 40K. So, it was in the scheme of things, not too bad. So transitioning after NZX, I had been talking to another potential employer about a job there at a bank, and that ended up falling through. I kind of knew it was going to fall through, but I was ready to move on at that point, so I just pulled the plug anyway. And I briefly started a China newsletter. It's a China news newsletter. So basically scanning, curated news service. So that didn't last very long, because my bank account didn't last very long. But I was just thinking about that before, that I didn't really know enough. I didn't really have the knowledge or context that I needed to make that successful, in a short amount of time. If I'd chipped away at that for, multiple years, then it would have turned into something differently. But after that, I moved to AXA, and on a contract economic analyst job. And then after that contract ended, I managed to get myself a job in the finance team there in a management accounting role, because I had that sort of corporate strategy background at NZX, so I was able to use that to keep my foot in the door there. And then I think less than a year later, an investment analyst job came up in the fund management team. So managed to get myself back into the fund management team. And from there, it was relatively plain sailing, except AMP, another large fund manager over this kind of part of the world, decided to take over the Australia-New Zealand operations of AXA. And so that meant, you know, in one of those interesting situations of restructuring and all that good stuff. I'm sure that if you have a corporate job for long enough, you'll go through many restructurings and takeovers and mergers and all the rest of it. So, but that was my first one, and I came out of that very fortunate, very lucky. The AMP had just laid off its New Zealand investment team about a year before that, so they then looked at the situation and said, okay, well, we've got an investment team here who's got a good track record, and our assets under management have just doubled overnight with the takeover, so maybe it makes sense to just keep these guys on and just move them up the road to their new office, and that's what happened. And then a couple of years later, a job came up in the Sydney office, investment strategist, and put my hand up for that and managed to get that and spend a couple of years in Sydney. And then from there, I guess in 2016, I had a couple of, you know, sort of minor frustrations, which, you know, if you work for a large corporate, you're going to always have, you know, frustrations. I think even actually, no matter what you're doing, you're always going to have certain frustrations. But, you know, I think that I was kind of, you know, getting ready to make some kind of move. And then one of the key research publications I do is the weekly macro themes. And I was doing a very similar report to that at AMP. And so I had been doing that for about 5 years there, I think. It started off as a five charts on Friday, and then it became sort of five themes to think about as my skills and knowledge and overall approach had improved. And I think just on reflection, that was a really good discipline to have, is to force myself to come up with five different ideas each week. I think that really helped accelerate my progress in economics and investment strategy. So I think pretty shortly after joining AXA/AMP, I decided that that's the path that I wanted to really start building on. Because I think, you know, yes, you've got to try a whole lot of different things, but then at a certain point, you know, it's good to go deep on something. And so, yeah, and then I'd also begun to expand the distribution of list of that internally from, you know, initially it was my own team, and then it was a couple of portfolio managers in New Zealand, and then a couple of portfolio managers in Australia. And then I just, when I moved to Australia, just added everybody in the company to it. And so, well, another good thing about that is that it helped boost my profile within the company, which is always a useful thing. But I had a couple of portfolio managers mention to me, you know, what you're doing here is pretty good. You ought to consider, you know, perhaps setting up your own thing. And having already done that a couple of times, you know, relatively unsuccessfully, I was quite, frankly, quite receptive to that idea, because, you know, if you start a business once, it's probably not going to be the last time. And I think that, you know, each time you do it, you probably learn a certain amount of things, and it prepares you, perhaps, you know, maybe you need to do it two or three times before you can actually be prepared to do it, you know, most successfully. But I guess all that culminated, we took the whole family for a holiday over to Bali, Indonesia, which is, you know, quite a common holiday spot for those in Australia, New Zealand. And one thing that I found about that is that you're just in a completely different space, like completely different sights and scenes, completely different weather. And what that allows you to get into a different headspace, and, you know, really gives you a good opportunity to reflect. And yeah, it's interesting that the hotel that we're staying at had this sort of mezzanine floor. So, well, the family were having their midday nap. I was up on that mezzanine floor, just busily jotting down some plans and thoughts, and really just crunching the numbers to see if it would work. And then, you know, I figured, well, I think I can make this work. And so took the wife down to the beach, and because we had the in-laws with us, so I left the kids with them and went down to the beach, had a couple of cocktails on the shore there, and said to her, well, this is what I'm thinking. What do you think? And she's like, yep, sounds good. And so that was it. That was the big moment. And then, of course, came back from holidays, and my boss, he doesn't work on Mondays. So I was sitting there on Monday, it was kind of a surreal day, just walking around the office thinking, you know, about the announcement that I was about to make. And boss came in on Tuesday and asked him if he had a minute, and told him that I decided to leave the company. And yeah, he was absolutely shocked. So and then from there, just that was it. So started the company on the 5th of September 2016. So I came back to New Zealand on the 1st of September 2016, first day of spring, which is, yeah, I guess perhaps metaphorical as well. And that kind of brings me to where, yeah, I guess the last 4 years, which has been trying to get a research business off the ground, and then, well, getting it off the ground, getting it to a point where it can continue indefinitely. And then right now I'm in the middle of the whole ongoing solo. So the first sort of 3 to 4 years has basically been solopreneur, and then now I've got research assistant, an admin assistant, and a part-time sales guy. So yeah, just trying to get my head around the whole idea of managing people, which managing yourself is hard enough, but managing, you know, getting things done through people is a whole new set of challenges, which is quite good, I guess. That's one of the most perhaps beneficial or interesting parts of going down this kind of path, is that it really is a journey of radical self-improvement and transformation.
So let's that's an awesome story, and there's a lot of parallels to my story there, in that we both started several companies. Some have been successful, some haven't. I did stuff just like you did, like around university time. I did an esports business then, which was a big, lots of people, like millions of people used it, but it didn't make money. So it wasn't a business, really. I was a little early on esports. And I tried to make a computer game, and I was, because I thought, oh, I built an esports site, I can make a computer game. I was utterly useless at game. But all these things teach you a huge amount of things. And I think what's so crucial for listeners is that, I totally agree with what Callum said, that, yeah, okay, some people, the first business they start becomes Facebook, but that's literally like 1 in 100 million people. most people are learning from mistakes, stuff goes wrong. They might be moonlighting, doing it in parallel with a job. I was working at Bain & Company after my PhD, and I was doing my esports business in parallel, which sounds impossible, but I was like 25 and I somehow made it work, to some degree. I think there's a lot of good advice in that. Why don't we start with what exactly is Top Down Charts? Like, before we get there, how's like the product evolved? What did it start off being? And how have you gone through? Because there's a product side, and then there's sort of the sales side, which I want to kind of go into them a little bit separately, because they're both super crucial. But without a product, you can't sell anything. So makes sense to start. Well, some people can. But let's maybe start with the product side.
Yeah, so I guess very briefly, so basically working with multi-asset investors to provide independent insights, and I sort of consider it doing that across three categories. So investment ideas, which is, you know, what's a good investment, what's a good market to either be long, overweight, leverage long, whatever, and then what is or underweight, as the case may be, and then risk management input. So that's that can be shorter term. So here's a bunch of tactical indicators that are lighting up that highlight downside risk. And then the third area is meaningful macro insights. So that's things like what's going on with central banking, global trade, etc. And that is to really give them background and perspective. And the reason I say meaningful is that it always has to be tied to some, you know, tied back to some sort of investment conclusion. So, you know, I sort of liken it to the fact that, you know, I didn't really study economics, but I do economics. So the way that I learned economics was trading currency options in university, and just in the same way as that, you know, I'm definitely not a mathematician. I failed high school maths, but I work with numbers, but going back to the product question, so yeah, that was quite an interesting evolution, really. So the first iteration was pretty much exactly the report that I was doing back at AMP. I mean, I changed the name, obviously, but it was very rough and ready in email form. So, you know, basically in an email with the topics and I don't even know if I had a summary of topics at that stage, but it was very raw, ready. You know, the charts were good, the insights were good, the presentation was, you know, I was probably overweight, content underweight presentation at that point. And I think that was probably the first evolution, was putting it into a PowerPoint and just making it look a lot more professional. And I think that was, you know, presentation matters. Communications, tremendously important. You know, people, rightly or wrongly, they're going to pick up your report, and if it looks good, they're probably going to be more likely to read it. If they don't like the fonts that you're using, or if it looks unprofessional, then it's going to, you know, it's going to reduce the amount of people that can actually read it. And as an analyst, it's so important to get your insights across. It's so important to have just general communication skills, which includes presentation of your actual work, and because it's just absolutely no sense in going ahead and coming up with the best analysis if you are unable to actually communicate that. So that was probably the first evolution, and then the next one was a monthly chart book. So that came about, I was going on a marketing trip. I think it was my first marketing trip to Australia, and that's probably a whole lot of different stories itself, but going on a marketing trip, you have to have some charts to talk to. So, you know, I produced a Word document with a whole bunch of charts in it, and you know, for a little bit of comments here and there. And I think I got comments on that trip. So I think somebody said, oh, you should do this as a regular monthly thing. And so I took that on board and came back and made a couple of adjustments to it. And then I had somebody who was taking a trial that didn't end up buying, they said, oh, you should put your a table of your tactical asset allocation views in there. So I was like, oh, yeah. Yeah, I definitely should. So I did that. And then I think about a year later, I had a client ask me whether I was producing capital market assumptions. And, you know, I'd done that in the past. And so I was like, well, no, but I will. So I started doing that and rolled that into the monthly chart book as well. And I think it was this year. There, it was this year I rebranded the markets. I think it was called the monthly chart book. I rebranded it to the Market Cycle Guidebook. And on the front page had these sort of big macro scope kind of things. So just basically a map of the cycle. So looking at a composite of hard data, composite of survey data, and a composite of inflation data, you know, globally. So it kind of gives you this one look, one second look of what's going on with the global economic cycle, and then a monetary policy map, again, at a global level, and then a valuation snapshot for equities. So, and then overall, just expanding the number of charts in there, but also making it focused more on medium to long-term sort of slower moving indicators, you know, a lot of things like valuations, cycle, monetary, and a bit of a further emphasis on capital market assumptions, basically really doubling down on the fact that most of my clients to date have been asset allocators, and that probably should be no surprise since that's the career or the work environment that I came from. I think, one, I've kind of developed my process, my thinking for that specific type of investing, and, you know, growing up, you know, career-wise in that space, I think it's probably, you know, the other thing is it's probably easier for me to talk to those people, so, you know, relative to perhaps some other investor group. And then a couple of years ago, also started the Global Cross Asset Market Monitor, and that was kind of partly for me, so that I could just, you know, systematically see what's going on across markets, which would give me ideas to go and do further work on, but also, you know, it's quite a useful sort of utility. It's more of a, you know, if you look at the kind of data or research products that are available, one end of the spectrum is, you know, pure research, pure insights. So, you know, I guess, you know, maybe that's just like somebody's opinion and some charts. And then at the other end of the spectrum would be pure utility, which would be, you know, Bloomberg data, for instance, or, you know, some other sort of data provider.
And so, can I just jump in on one thing there? So one thing I've heard a lot from you is that you clearly you're talking to customers a lot, and that's important.
Yes.
It feels to me you're doing what I think is exactly the right way to do stuff, which is you're trying to find that product market fit. You're talking to customers, they're giving you feedback, and not everyone gives feedback if you ask for it, right? I mean, in fact, but you know, if you're in a room with someone and you actually ask them, you know, what was helpful, what else could be helpful, and then you get a whole bunch of ideas. So how did you filter those ideas? Because you can't do, if you did everything everyone says or suggests, you're probably going to have 100 different products and all of them will be terrible. So you've got to somehow focus.
I think that's kind of, yeah. I mean, my first impression, the first response that I'd say to that would be that I think probably about a year or two ago, I kind of made my mind up that, you know, who my actual niche was. I think on day one, I was sort of the view, oh, you know, this is going to be awesome for everyone. Everyone's going to want this. This is, you know, corporate people are going to want this. Hedge funds are going to want this. You know, this is, everyone's, you know, equity investors, fixed income investors. And to be fair, I do have a couple of sort of outliers on my client list, but for the most part, it's asset allocators and, you know, more specifically, it's active asset allocators who take a top-down view and ideally have a global mandate or global universe. So if you know what your niche is, and you know the kind of client that you want to get or you want to have more of, and you have somebody try out your product and they're not that and they give you some suggestion, you certainly listen to it and you consider it. But then you also, to a certain degree, discount it because they're not the target market. So for instance, if I had a hedge fund say, oh, you know, we're more after short-term trading ideas, I'd say, okay, well, that's interesting, but, you know, I'm not really targeting people who have a one-month performance window. You know, I'm more targeting people who have, look at performance over sort of a, you know, a market cycle or, you know, at least a year, if not a 2 to 3 year time frame. So that's probably the main way I'd filter that. I guess the other thing would be if it's something that they keep asking for, or, you know, that multiple people ask for, then it's kind of becomes obvious. The other thing is if I was considering it myself, you know, if I had it on, you know, somewhere down the bottom of my to-do list and somebody says, you know, are you thinking about doing this? Then, yeah, you bump that up the priority list.
Yeah, I mean, a bit of confirmation bias is always good, right? So, it's like a recurring joke on this podcast, but like...
Yeah. And I think also... overall, it's really does it actually fit with what you're doing? So, if somebody said, you know, have you got any charts on such and such asset class? And my, you know, 99% of the time, my answer is yes. And then, you know, I go away and furiously work on developing that indicator set. So that's actually, you know, so I mean, part of that. So I do really encourage clients to ask me questions and, you know, not be afraid to sort of say, you know, what's your view on this, or, you know, have you got charts on this? Because it's been a good prompt for me to, expand coverage, but also it's quite good to just see what people are thinking about. And, I've actually just over the last couple of weeks taken that to the next level. So, I'm now doing a Zoom call to on a weekly basis to actually go through the core weekly report that I do. So, and there's basically a few different types of reasons why I'm doing that. You know, one is it's good to just provide a bit more context. It's good for getting a bit of two-way communications going. So, you know, ultimately, it sort of ends up with a bit of general Q&A. And I think it's good for clients to even hear what types of questions each other are asking. And it's still quite a nascent initiative, but I think it's going to be quite a good thing. So yeah,
that's also interesting, because one of the issues in a startup is, so if you want to think about how something can scale, right? So, you having individual conversations with 50 people a week isn't that scalable, because you can't, well, you can with 50, but you can't with 500. It's just not possible. And they want to speak to you. They don't actually want to speak to someone else. You can't just hire someone, because they want your insights. And at some point that can change, of course, but like, so I thought what's interesting there is you've got to move.
That sort of hits on that whole, is bigger better or better? Because it's like, what's your number?
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
But also, it feels like you've just gone through, it's very normal to go through a process of, working out who your customer really is. Oh, it's not going to be 8 billion people in every business on the planet. Well, that's okay. Bloomberg is not with 8 billion people in every business on the planet. Mm-hmm. It just charges a lot for the relatively small number of people that use it. And then what's interesting is, 2020 is probably, one thing it's going to be known for is the year of Zoom. And, it sounds like you piggybacked on the fact that people are now much more comfortable hopping on a call, make it regular. That's fine. And actually probably people are going to have less expectations of people doing in-person kind of road trips.
Which is good. Marketing trips are kind of, they're kind of fun sometimes, but it's a lot of time that gets burned, sitting on a plane, waiting for a plane, and, figuring out the meetings and figuring out the logistics, all the rest of it. So, I think I put it on Twitter one day is, I'm not sure if I ever will do another business trip. I mean, I will, but I don't feel the need to.
Yeah, I know. I think it's a big thing. Okay, well, what was your first sale? I think everyone always remembers their first sale.
Yes. The first sale was AMP Capital, so my old employer.
Well, that's awesome.
Which was it was actually really good, because it did a couple of things. So, I mean, first of all, it was a vote of confidence. So I could tell people, this is basically a vote of confidence and a sign that I left on good terms. So that was a pretty good one. The second one, I guess the first non-friend, well, the second one I think was actually also friendly. So it was a, an ex-colleague had gone to a different firm, and they got me onto a web call, which is lucky because I didn't have the I don't think I had the money at that stage to afford to buy a plane ticket. So luckily we managed to do that one over I think it was Blue Jeans, another version of Zoom. But yeah, actually that reminds me, the first so in pulling the trigger to make this decision to go out and start the company, it was kind of a trade-off because, I think ideally at some level you want to have a nice big pile of savings before you go out and start, because that just gives you a bit of extra cushion, and means that you don't have to necessarily be so scrambling or whatever, or less stressful. But in the end, I figured, well, actually, it's better to just time and sweat equity is more important than having some savings or capital. So yeah, I decided that was one sort of dilemma or thing that I had to think through when I went to pull the trigger. And so yeah, and rather than having savings, I ended up having I think a bit of personal debt and credit card debt. I can't remember the exact mechanics, but I was doing something like doing a cash advance, no, doing a balance transfer, which would pay 2% for interest for a 6 month period, and then doing cash advance to get that out, and then I'd take that and pay the payments on a personal loan or something. I figured I better keep my Australian credit record clean just in case I need to go back there.
And when were you confident that you kind of first had a business that you thought, well, actually, that maybe that's just the question, first actually had a business that could survive and thrive? So. Well, are you still confident? I think you are now, but.
Oh, definitely. I think I had pretty high conviction from day one that, I was going to make something work. I think that when you get to that point, you have a level of conviction that is not going to be shaken. I mean, I almost feel like I didn't have any plan B. I didn't mentally have any backup plan. It was, well, if somebody said, and I think somebody did ask me, oh, what are you going to do if it doesn't work? I mean, that just wasn't in my reality. That just wasn't in my universe of possible outcomes. So it was, I was going to figure something out. And but in terms of where, because I mean, yeah, cash flow matters. If you run out of cash, and it's pretty bad, and that can cause a lot of pressure and all sorts of other stress, especially when you've got a family. But I think the point where I was sort of, was probably late 2017. Yeah, it was probably late 2017. I'd started to get a, I think, started to get the product into a bit more shape, started to get my, my pitch, my message a little bit more into shape, even though, it was still relatively rudimentary at that stage. But I think by that stage, I was getting enough inquiries, enough clients to think, and I think just in general, enough cash flow to, keep the bank account balance a little bit, sufficiently higher than zero. But the one thing I should mention actually is that I sent my wife to work on the first 2 years. So yeah, she was basically paying the bills, and I was, yeah, just trying to keep my head above water. But I think it was 2018. Yeah, 2018, she stopped working. So basically, I mean, that was kind of a key milestone. And then, yeah, at the end of 2018, we're doing good enough to basically buy a house. because we had been living in this little cabin. So I brought this cabin for, I can't remember the exact figure, but it was high five figures, so something like 90, 80, something like that. This little cabin in the motor camp of Queenstown, New Zealand. And so Queenstown, for context, I think the average price there, whether it's average or median, it's probably 1 million plus. You can spend a lot of money there. I mean, realistically, if you want a really nice place there with a really nice view, you're going to need to spend at least 2-3 million plus. But we bought the cabin, but not the ground. So we're on this lease, which made the living costs quite affordable. Ultimately they decided not to roll the lease over. So we had to figure out some alternative means of accommodation. But luckily, by that stage, you know, had actually gotten to a point where, the current annualized income, but also the forecast, I had to go and get an accountant to do some forecasts, which to make it look like I could afford a mortgage.
Right, and so then you moved down south, right, to Invercargill, mm-hmm. where you get a lot more.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we kind of made the call of, do we want to spend? I think we're able to spend about 700, and do you want to spend that money in Queenstown and maybe not even be able to get anything, maybe like a one bedroom apartment or something like that, or some sort of house with something seriously wrong with it, or do we want to go back down south? So my parents are in Invercargill, important piece of context and important deciding factor when you've got a young family. We just decided, well, let's just go the opposite direction. Let's go and get it like a lifestyle block. So a lifestyle block is where you've got a couple of paddocks and a house. We got a pretty nice house that was, so I think it's 240 square meters. I don't know what that is in square foot. And our previous house was 60 square meters, which we had my wife and I, our two kids, and my wife's parents living with us in that place. So very, very Hong Kong style setup, yes. I think. But our new place, even the sheds where they were 100 square meters. So we decided to go completely the opposite direction, which in hindsight was a pretty good setup to have when lockdown came. That's for sure.
Absolutely. And so what were any particularly painful moments, any times you thought you might want to jack it in, even if it was only for a few minutes, kind of key learnings from the first 4 years? Because it's rarely just all up to the right, right? If you were to draw a chart, it's probably not all up to the right. The VIX would be quite high in most entrepreneurial adventures.
So let's see if I can remember them all. I do remember actually one thing that one quite kind of weird detail is in the first year or two I would have a nap every day just after lunch, my in-laws, so they're from China, so my wife's from China, and the practice is that they come and help you look after the baby, and which they're doing, and they were really good support as well. So that was really helpful. They were basically looking after the kids, so babysitting and cooking. That was pretty substantial help. But after lunch they had this habit of having a nap, and I was burning the candles at both ends. So I figured this is pretty good idea. So I'd have my nap, and I think for a while there I'd have this sort of recurring thing where I'd wake up and I just have this, for want of a better term, just a sense of what the hell am I doing? even though I had conviction in what I was doing, but you just had this the subconscious voice just chiming in every now and then. I guess the first setback, was probably, I think it was going to be my third client. And it was, pretty big name company, but I was only dealing with one person there, and you know, I hadn't managed to sort of, you know, spread the tentacles through the organization yet. And so that he was basically ready to go on my first marketing trip. You know, he was, I think, my last meeting, and you know, he was like, "Yep, that sounds like a good price. Yep, that's all good to go. Send me a contract when you get back." And yes, I sent him the contract, and you know, didn't hear back. And then I think I followed up a couple of weeks later, maybe 3 weeks later or something. And he was like, "Oh, I'm just about to go on holiday. I'll get it done when I get back." And then, so I was like, "Oh, okay, fair enough." And then I think maybe a couple of weeks after that, I got a bounced email from, you know, when I sent out the reports. And so I was like, "Oh, that's strange." So I looked at the bounced email thing. I mean, you know, it's a fairly common thing. And so this user no longer exists. That's pretty weird. He didn't mention anything about, you know, leaving or anything like that. So I thought, "Oh, well, we'll go and Google News his name." And then one of the first results that came up was an obituary. So, yeah, I mean, obviously it wasn't good for him and his family, but, you know, what would have been the client number three, that was pretty pretty meaningful setback. But it did give me sort of, you know, strike you a bit, because it, you know, you do sort of get set in your ways, and, you know, you project everything is going to, you know, discontinue, but then, you know, you get reminded of your mortality like that. So it's,
did you get the client eventually or no?
Well, no, because I was only dealing with him, and he was setting up or spearheading like the division, a certain division, and with him going, that division was basically wound up. So
that's kind of the key. It's a really, you know, important learning as well. Like,
Follow up earlier. If I'd followed up, I mean, like, you know, it's kind of a bad taste joke, but if I'd followed up earlier, then I would have got it signed and paid, and before the grim happened.
Right. Absolutely. Like, always, I mean, the classic thing in sales is, "Oh, yeah, I'll get that done. Oh, next week. Oh, okay. Well, no rush to send the contract. Get it to me in a few days." It's like, well, actually, the most aggressive sales people will be like, "Here's the contract. Why don't you sign it right now?" And then, of course, people can't, because it has to go through legal, but it keeps the momentum. Yep. And then the other thing is to have a multi-threaded approach. So obviously you were dealing with the guy who sounded like he could make the decision, sign the contract. But then something, actually in this case, tragic happened. Other times people leave a company and then you're suddenly nowhere. So having...
I'll read you out the post.
It's very important, so...
Yeah, I'll read you out the post-it note that I wrote up, I think, fairly shortly after that. It says, "Follow up early, follow up often. If in doubt, follow up. Just get over yourself and follow up." You know, because it is that sort of, you know, internal battle that you fight, where it's like, "Oh, you know, I don't want to be annoying."
But you see, on that, I've learned over the years, because I've built my most successful business that I helped build. I started it. Internationally, it was a US business outside of US, and built it in like 15 countries. So I've seen every culture of sales in all these different countries. Mm-hmm. And it's a very British/New Zealand thing to be like, and I wouldn't put Australia in that category, right? It's a very British/New Zealand thing to be like, "Oh, I don't want to annoy this person," because I know everyone gets so much email and you know, years ago, voicemail and whatever, right? And then you do a trip in America with, in effect, experienced enterprise salespeople that have worked at, you know, Salesforce, SAP, these types of places. And they're drilled in follow-up. And they're not drilled. Sure, you should absolutely not spam someone like 10 times a week. That's not going to get you anywhere. But they're absolutely drilled to follow up. And to be fair, the people they're selling to do understand that. And that was sort of the epiphany for me, which is most people you're dealing with, if you're going to do an enterprise contract, that person's probably done enterprise contracts with other people. They're well aware there's a sales process, and they're well aware that you want to try and get it closed. And if they want to buy your product, they will get it done. If they're
and people are busy,
but they don't really want to buy it, they'll stall. Pretty simple.
Oh yeah, Exactly. But people are busy and they forget to do things. And, you know, sometimes people just need that extra prodding. I know I've been looking at a data service and, you know, I pretty much want to buy it, but they haven't followed up with me. So, you know, I'd probably, if they just were a little bit more aggressive in their follow up, I'd already have signed on long ago. So it's, yeah.
All right. So what, before we move on to like macro a bit, like the big question is, would you do it again if you went back 4 years, knowing what you know, knowing what you know now? I know the answer, but like, you know, would you do it all again?
Yeah. So I guess, I mean, very brief. Well, yes, but very briefly. So the way I see it, I had basically three different options at that stage, you know, or three different sort of pathways I was considering. One was that I was basically engineering internally at like a transfer to the China office. That would have been very interesting, but also perhaps a challenging sort of period to be in China as a Westerner. And then the other one would have been to just, you know, climb the ladder sort of thing, potentially outside the organization. And, you know, neither of those, I mean, the China one would have been an adventure, would have been interesting, but I think that ultimately it would have been the wrong thing for me. And I think the other option of just, you know, keeping on going, but changing perhaps my perspective a bit and perhaps changing the way I looked at things or did things, which is, yeah, I think worth just briefly sort of fixating on, because I think that some people think, oh, you know, my job sucks, my company sucks, and therefore I should go and start my own business, which maybe that is a good option, and maybe that is the right thing for them to do. But sometimes maybe it's actually just, well, maybe your company doesn't suck, but actually you actually suck a little bit, and you need to look in the mirror and take more ownership and double down with what you're doing, or you know, change your approach, because you know, I don't think it's a good idea to go, you know, jump from corporate to solopreneur just because you know you're frustrated with certain personalities or dynamics or you know, just ways things are done in the corporate world, because you're going to swap that set of frustrations for another set of frustrations, or one set of challenges for another set of challenges. So, you know, I don't think it's, if anyone's sitting there thinking, you know, mulling this decision over at the moment, just make sure that you do it for the right reasons. Cause I did have, you know, some sort of push factors that, made me think that I wanted to, you know, I was ready to move on, but, it was a really positive step. You know, I was like, well, this is the vision that I want to build. You know, this is what I want to do. This is the person I want to become. This is where I want to be. And so, yeah, I think that's, yeah, but back to your question, I almost forgot your question. Is, yes, I definitely would. I'd probably do things slightly different, but you know, that's just because I've gone up a learning curve. Yeah.
Very good.
Actually, one thing that I would do differently would have been to do more networking, and perhaps a little bit more on sales skills, you know, somehow before starting, because I think, you know, the bigger your network is, which is, that is a kind of interesting thing though. I didn't really go to much networking events when I was in Sydney, but you know, when I was in my final years of university, I was at every single networking, finance-related networking event that I could find in New Zealand, so, which, you know, definitely helped. So, yeah, that's one piece of eternal wisdom, and maybe now it's more social networking than traditional, you know, go to a seminar and sit around at cocktail hour afterwards and talk to people.
Right.
Hand out business cards. If anyone actually has business cards.
Oh, they, well, come on, come to Hong Kong and Asia. There's business cards everywhere.
But, yeah.
But I think that's a really important point. And whilst, of course, it's changed from 20 years ago to now, and I think it's pretty clear there's going to be less massive conferences where everyone's together. I mean, that's a whole separate point in terms of how that's going to affect some industries. But because the tools are getting, already people are building tools to enable much better, virtual conferences. And obviously there's a lot of money to be saved. But
but it is still fun to go to those and have a few drinks and, you know.
Right, yeah. Well, someone will
bullshit a bit, you know.
But what I always found was, on that, I've seen people, I've been to some virtual conferences and there have been drink sessions where you just have a beer and you're on like this kind of Zoom-like environment. Yeah. And that can get much more immersive with virtual reality, of course.
Oh, yeah. That could be interesting, but finding new interesting bars and things afterwards. And yeah.
But my point on networking is like,
yep.
It's something that I think everyone has to find what works for them. Because so I'm the guy at the conference that doesn't want to go and speak to everyone. I want to go into the corner and speak to the three people I already know, because it's just, mm-hmm. I'm kind of quite introverted in that way. That's not the only test if you're introverted. If there's a Myers-Briggs expert listening, I'm aware of that. Yeah. But what I do tend to do is the people I build a relationship with, I want to like a really deep one with them. And so I know that if I ever ask for anything, they'll always help me. They'll go out of their way to help, because I've probably helped them many, many times. But you can't do that with thousands of people. You can do that with dozens of people around the world. And I thought, it's quite interesting if you have that kind of network in one or two people in every country that you can almost kind of call on when you need some help. And that's kind of served me pretty well. And so for me, that, you know, whilst I still have everyone's business cards and stuff, because I've been living in Asia 5 years, you know, I do sometimes go through them and ask people for help. And, you know, obviously the response rates on that is much lower, but it still tends to be okay. But what's super interesting on social media, and you know, you've got a much bigger presence than I have, is I think once you have a bit of a reputation within FinTwit or whatever it might be, could be on Instagram or whatever, then if your name's kind of relatively well known, if you do reach out to someone and ask for help or for a favor, I get incredibly high response rates. I've just found that because there's this community and we all feel part of it. So, you know, I wonder when businesses are going to really understand that.
Well, I wouldn't have a business if it wasn't for social media. You know, I didn't have that many personal contacts. I was, you know, going into the independent research world, I think there's quite a lot of, you know, ex-sell side guys, you know, ex-key strategists or whatever. They probably had a, you know, massive list of contacts, and, you know, they probably had a big distribution list before they, you know, went and started their shop, and they probably would have got a bunch of clients on day one. But for me, I, you know, had a, basically the people that I worked with were in my network, you know, my real life network. But, so, you know, on the back of personal contacts, I'll get it off the ground, but I wouldn't have gone much further than that. But just, you know, time and time again, I've found that if somebody's been following you on Twitter and what you've been doing on Twitter is valuable to them, or certainly if there's been some, you know, bit of banter, but even if you're just putting up something that's valuable, that changes the whole dynamics just profoundly. It makes them more receptive to taking a call. They might treat you a bit differently than you know, some other provider who they haven't, you know, may not have heard of before. And price negotiation, obviously that's an important part as well. It helps. Awareness of what you're doing, you know, it's I think, you know, this is something that would probably be surprising to hear me say, that, you know, to a certain extent, I think the research business, you know, independent research business has almost become a little bit commoditized, because you've had a lot of new entrants. I think the barriers to entry perhaps are lower.
And a lot of people have left the bulge bracket. I mean, my wife used to work at Morgan Stanley. Yep. A lot of people have left. Mm. That's a pretty dying industry at the bulge bracket, because so many conflicts of interest. Yes, they can work the Chinese walls and whatnot, but it's all, everyone knows it's a bit of a sham.
and layoffs, and a lot of layoffs as well. Exactly. So, But I mean, you know, in some ways, I almost think of it like the restaurant business, you know, which is a notoriously difficult business to operate in. But you know, if you have good cooking, and well, just by itself, if you have good, really good cooking, you can have a thriving restaurant business. Or if you have really, you know, well, I think you still have to have good cooking. But if you have good cooking and a big name, you know, you can still have a big business. You know, if you think of, like, you know, at the extreme end of town, you know, the Gordon Ramsays and the Jamie Olivers of the world. So I think, you know, especially if you're and you know, I don't think it is commoditized, because I think that, you know, for instance, what I'm doing is differentiated enough. I think that I have a unique perspective. But if you did assume that it was, you know, somewhat commoditized, then you have to be very conscientious about building brand and getting attention, because you know, it comes back to that. And I kind of feel bad for saying this, but I'm going to use the statement, which is 1,000 true fans. I haven't actually read the book of the same title, but you know, all you need is 1,000 true fans that are that, you know, that really are true believers in what you're doing, and value what you're doing, and they're going to support you.
Yeah,
and it's really just a matter of coming up with something that coming up with something and a way of charging them.
Yeah, very good. And all right, so why don't we? I mean, look, you've alluded to it, and we have to cover it to some degree. Like, how do you? What's your kind of framework or process for assessing the kind of macro environment? I mean. Yep. Or we could just kind of hop into views on, I mean, there's a lot going on. 2020 has been a complete, I mean, I don't know how to describe it, but I've spoken to a lot of hedge fund managers recently, and they're all saying the same thing. A lot of them did really well at the beginning of the year because they did see the COVID stuff coming. This is the people I've spoken to, and then, and on the podcast and privately, but then a lot of them have had a really tough kind of Q3. Every time they thought the market would go one way, it went the other. There's, you know, and of course, everyone on Twitter is a billionaire. That's another meme on this podcast. So, because everyone's a perfect investor, of course.
Yeah, it's interesting too, the job titles that people give themselves as well on there.
Yes. Yeah, well. Yeah.
I won't go into detail, but yeah.
There's probably not too much people fact-checking Twitter profiles. So.
Yeah.
But, you know, putting it all together, we're coming to the end of the year. There's a rather important election next week, which... listening to some is going to cause civil war. Listening to others will be a nothing burger. You know, so there's just so much going on. How do we even begin to synthesize it all?
Yeah, so I will start very quickly with my process. So basically, it's at a highest possible level, it's one of pragmatism. So, and what that means is I will start with some sort of valuation anchor. And that can be absolute valuation, relative value, and half the time some of the times it means actually creating some sort of new indicator, because there may not be any reliable or, you know, sensible indicator to use, and ideally something that's quite quantitative, so that, you know, it does give you some sort of objective perspective. And I like to have that as the anchor or the starting point, because then it's really just filling in the details around that. So and the details around that, the next step would be to bring in cycle factors. So that would be earnings cycle, economic cycle, supply cycle, depending on what the asset class is. Then the monetary factor, so monetary policy, financial conditions, obviously a critical piece of the equation. And then, and so I'd consider those three sort of factors or buckets as the slower moving part. And then the more tactical side of things would be the technicals, positioning, sentiment, flows, just anything that gives insight into the timing aspect. Because I mean, ultimately, what I'm on the long side or the buying side, what I'm looking for is something that is undervalued, where the cycle's you know, pretty bad but turning up, where monetary policy or financial conditions gone really easy, and ideally where the tactical indicators are lighting up to the upside. So maybe a breakout or some seriously oversold technicals, or, you know, sentiments, extreme pessimism, light positioning, extreme outflows. You don't always get, that what you want, which is, that perfect. That's when the stars are aligned. And so that's what I'm, kind of looking for on the buy side. On the sell side, it's the opposite of that, or the short side or the risk side is the opposite of that. So my perspective is risk is being underexposed to assets that have that kind of characteristics, or being overexposed to assets which have the opposite of that. And then, it may not necessarily always start with valuation. Maybe it starts with technicals, and then you go, a certain market might be breaking out, and then it's like, oh, okay, well, let's fill out the picture. Let's see if that's actually just noise, or whether that's something to really go for. And the reason why I do that is that you want to raise your conviction level as high as possible. I think, for investing, one of the key inputs is conviction, because a lack of conviction means that you don't put a big enough position on, and you don't make enough, or you don't even put it on to begin with. A lack of conviction mean that you don't get out fast enough, or you don't get out when you should have. So that's basically how I approach markets from a process standpoint. Try to see things as they are, try to minimize, traditional forecasting. I mean, of course, ultimately we are forward looking, and, we're trying to form some opinion about the risk return outlook, but try to be data driven. I don't produce any sort of point forecast, for instance. Must define and frame the key risks of drivers for each asset class. Must know what indicators, charts to watch and monitor, and strive for constant improvement. That's one thing that I think that I'm pretty good at is innovation, like coming up with new indicators, new charts, new ways of looking at things. When I'm doing that, that's kind of when I have the most joy in my work as well. So that's basically my process. In terms of how I'm seeing things at the moment, the obvious question is, what's going to happen with the election and COVID and vaccines and Brexit, and geopolitics. There's a long list of downside risks, and I think a decent list of upside risks as well. But there is, I guess, this sort of cloud of uncertainty that's hanging around. And I mean, the way I look at things, basically I say, okay, well, here's some things that we can't know. So let's go back to basics. What can we know? We can know that we've got the greatest amount of monetary stimulus in the system, I think, either for a long time or on record, certainly on record if you look at certain indicators. Massive fiscal stimulus, coordination of monetary easing across countries. You've got central banks coming out of a policy mistake in 2018 where globally central banks starting too much for too long into the wrong type of situation with the trade war in the background. And therefore, they're going to be much more likely to let things run further, hotter, whatever, than they did before. That was my view back at the start of the year. And then, the Fed has kind of come around to my view that, that they're going to let inflation run hotter for longer because, it's sort of like this, they've been under for so long that they're going to go over for so long to kind of make up for it. And you've got a lot of green shoots, global trade indicators turning up. So like hard activity data, a lot of my leading indicators pointing to global growth rebound, green shoots and earnings. My base underlying economic case, which yes, it could be rattled around. So it could be improved if you had more stimulus. It could be improved if you had a vaccine faster than expected, or some sort of breakthrough that we can't figure out at this moment. And it could be delayed by more virus, more shutdown, geopolitical events. So, but you know, going back to what we can know, going back to the indicators, the charts, what we can know is that typically when you get the setup, we see a global economic rebound. And that being the starting point, it would tend to, all else equal, make you want to favour risk assets over the medium term, or certainly over the cycle, and you know, be perhaps a little bit more cautious on defensive assets. And when you look at valuations, most defensive assets are extremely expensive. Bonds are extremely expensive. Gold's extremely expensive. REITs still, you know, on the expensive side. Meanwhile, commodities look cheap. US equities don't look cheap, but the rest of the world looks very cheap still. So developed ex-US, emerging markets, frontier markets. So I'm inclined to, from a medium-term standpoint, I'm sitting here saying go overweight equities or stay overweight equities. I said go overweight equities back in March, April. Stay overweight equities, risk assets, commodities, prefer global ex-US versus US, prefer value versus growth, prefer emerging markets, frontier markets, bearish US dollar on a medium term. And I think that's kind of like the high-level views. And then from a short-term standpoint, and probably really just looking for buying opportunities. I mean, if, again, it's, you know, you're always looking at the short-term indicators for risk flags. And, you know, I didn't pound the table back in February that we should be selling. You know, still, the way I characterized it was that I came into 2020 basically right, but ended up wrong for reasons that you could never, factor in. I guess it's wrong for the right reasons, which is basically your process told you to be bullish, but something came out of left field. And because I was quite early to that in 2019, sort of Q4, you know, September, I was very out of consensus back then, saying that we were going to have a global upturn, which did get underway, but obviously got derailed. But anyway, what I was trying to say there was that in February, I had a bunch of, at least three or four charts that said, you know, risk flags are waving at this point for equities on a short-term basis. So, you know, in hindsight, I should have pounded the table a bit then, but, you know, in general, if I've got a strong view on the medium term, then I'm not going to be inclined to chase the short term if it's inconsistent with that. Ideally, I want the two to align, which they did, you know, a couple of months later. So, yeah, in terms of the election, it's...
Can I just jump in on that last
point? Yeah, go for it.
I think that's an important point, is that, and I know that, for example, I mean, I subscribe to Hedgeye, and I know that Keith often confuses some subscribers on this exact thing, and he's not trying to confuse them, but and Raoul's talked about this a lot too. Like, it's perfectly okay to have different views on different timeframes. And you could have, some people have short-term, long-term, others have short, medium, long, like whatever works for you. But like, if you're long something in medium, long-term, for example, a great example could be, your thesis could be, well, I believe governments, politicians are never going to, they don't care about deficits. They're going to just basically create lots of money. I'm trying not to say print money because that offends some people. Ultimately leading to, in effect, MMT being a permanent thing. And this is going to destroy fiat currency against hard assets. It's a perfectly valid narrative that plenty of people subscribe to, and some people don't. But it might be in the short term, it's like, and so in that narrative, you would be long something like gold. But at the same time, and probably stocks too. But at the same time, there could be a short-term narrative, which is, well, you know what? Like, I mean, we just saw it, well, on Wednesday, let's get the time zones right. I always use US time zones. So on Wednesday, 28th of October, we just had the huge dollar up day. Everything else gets eviscerated, and, you know, including gold. And so there's, you know, there could be some short-term trends that are different. And it's if those time frames are aligning, that's often the time to get more aggressive on bets or investments. And if they're not aligning, be a little more cautious. So you know, I think sometimes people, there's nothing wrong having different views on different time frames.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I don't know if you, I mean, I'm no expert on the election, but did you want to talk about, did you want to force me to talk about that?
No, I don't want to force you to talk about anything. I mean, it's
I spent
a long time on Twitter deliberately trolling people. I wanted to elicit responses from both sides. I don't vote. I'm not American. I actually don't really care who wins. I believe my portfolio is set up to not really care who wins. That's sort of been my point. But it's been amazing seeing responses. I mean, the emotion is high and data is being thrown out the window. And all data, if you're a Republican, all data is stupid. Because in 16, it was wrong, except it wasn't really very wrong. It was 1.1% out nationally. And if you had the same swing as in 16, then Biden wins Texas. They forget to mention that one. Because actually, the polls overestimated what Trump was going to get in Texas. So there's a lot of emotion. And on the Dem side, it tends to be, it's all data, data, data. Look what the data say. Okay. But then again, you know, there's...
Well, the other thing too is, you know, there's always going to be a certain level of recency bias there as well, because everyone's going to be like, well, you know, the polls were wrong in 2016. They're wrong about Brexit. They're wrong about Trump.
Yeah, but 2018 was nailed by the traditional pollsters. And in fact, the new pollsters that did well in 16 did badly in 18. But everyone's forgotten that already because it wasn't a presidential. Yeah.
Well, one thing that I found was quite interesting. I posted this on Twitter the other day. So it's a poll of polls for undecided. So it's the unknowns undecided. And in 2016, so this time in 2016, it was about 10%. And the current reading is about 5%, so fully half. And it's halved in, you know, since September. So it's come down a lot faster than that time. But I think, you know, part of that was that there was this theory or idea that, you know, the Trump voters were kind of hiding in the unknowns or the undecideds because they didn't want to, you know, they didn't want to admit to it or something like this. There was this sort of, what do they call them? Shy voters or something.
OOT, Obama Trump voters that didn't want to play. That was proven to be a really major thing after 16.
Yeah.
You know what?
Yeah, I mean, the indicators that I look at, they just, they point, you know, I sort of feel quite nervous to put a view up on this, you know, given the 2016 experience. But my indicators picked Trump to win in 2016 and they're picking Biden to win at the moment. So
I read
what it's worth.
And I agree with that. And I also think people are very emotional. And I actually prefer listening to people not in the US who don't vote.
Yeah.
Because it is emotional. I'm sorry, but if you had something about the UK or you just had a New Zealand election, then I will get more emotional about the UK one and you will on the New Zealand one, no matter who you voted for. It's just natural, and I get that. I had this idea the other day that I kind of thought, well, you know what I'm actually seeing is that I think you're going to get a bunch of hidden Biden voters, which are people that voted for Trump last time. So not OOT voters, Obama, Trump. You're going to get the more just always Republican voters who just cannot vote for Trump. And the absolute Trumpians are, of course, going to vote for Trump, whatever he does. And what was really interesting is there was an article. This is another classic case of confirmation bias. I think The Hill ran an article like literally yesterday saying the same thing, but they actually had some data to show that this is probably a thing. And it's they're trying to explain why you're getting some kind of polls which are super skewed to Biden. Like there was this Wisconsin one yesterday that was 17%. I don't think anyone believes Wisconsin's going to be 17% Biden, but I mean it was a high quality poll. But it would be very and the other thing I think people drastically underestimate is the vast majority of pollsters are neutral. There are absolutely some that do internal polls for the Democrats and Republicans, and they're not so neutral. Now, why on internal polls you want to get fake data, I don't know, but you know, but the vast majority of pollsters, their life, it's like when you're doing your charts and your analysis, you...
Yeah, I'm fiercely independent, so I don't want to have my independence sort of questioned.
And 16 was a massive blow to the industry, even though really it was three swing states and a very small number of votes. And they nailed it in 18. I mean, basically the House and Senate votes then, they absolutely nailed it. And a lot of the people that nailed it in 16 didn't do well because they overestimated Trump. And, you know, they've all changed their sampling for non-college educated whites. Now, there may be something else that's a surprise this time. Hey, there might be a surprise that swings it to Biden more. We don't know. But it's they're not deliberately trying to have, like, fake data. Yep. I just don't understand why people think this. It makes no sense.
Yeah. Well, one thing that I just kind of reflected on after our own election over here in New Zealand, it was basically a pandemic response endorsement. So just for anyone who's sort of not up to play, so when the virus started kicking off over here, sort of back in February, March, we went into, I think it was a 4 or 5 week lockdown, and, you know, pretty aggressive lockdown, and pretty much wiped it out. If you look at the polling of Labor, who won the election, prior to the lockdown, it was sort of 40%. Post-lockdown, it was 60%. So, you know, it was basically an endorsement of their, you know, their handling of the election. Of the,
landslide, right? One of the most interesting victories for a long time.
So. Yeah, but then, you know, it is a centre, I mean, it is a left of centre government. I mean, you know, in the scheme of things, quite a centrist. But definitely has... a clear sort of left-leaning agenda, certainly a policy agenda. And I guess sort of the interesting side effect of the pandemic is that you basically have a left-leaning government who thinks that they've got a, you know, they kind of can perceive that, you know, as an endorsement or the go-ahead to put a whole bunch of left-leaning policies in place. And, you know, just why I thought of that was... you know, arguably one thing that has helped swing things a little bit, perhaps, is the lack of virus response in America. And I guess that could end up, again, being a side effect of the pandemic, is that you, in America, like here, you actually have a unintended swing to, you know, or sort of drift to the left a bit. And of course, there's all these sort of background features which would perhaps argue for that anyway. But, you know, it's a... one of those many side effects of the pandemic that we're going to become more familiar with as time goes on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, how are you, but in terms of investing, how are you looking at the election in terms of, well, look, if it's a Democratic sweep, then maybe this happens. If it's, you know, a non-sweep, you know, the different scenarios, or is it more just like... Because some people are just the way some people are trading this is, I just want to be hugely in cash because honestly, it's an election, anything can happen. And I just want to live to fight another day. And I actually think for a lot of traders, that's a perfectly good rationale to have right now.
Yeah, well, I just put my poll back up on Twitter. So I asked this one earlier in the month because I was writing a theme on that in my weekly report about how, you know, my theory is that it actually, to some extent, doesn't matter who wins because if you just get that key well-known event risk off the table, then you know, you open the way up for you know, people unwinding their hedges because the responses here are, you know, in terms of your exposure to risk assets, equities with regards to the US election, have you done any of the following: reduced exposure, put on downside hedges, both, neither. At least 50% there have said that they've put on either reduced exposure or put on hedges. You can see it in the indicators, anecdotally. You know, certainly I'm getting a lot of questions about sort of what do we do. You know, I think that, and you look at cash indicators, cash levels are fairly high, indicators of hedging very high. So I guess just a simple unwinding of hedges, restoration of any underweights, you know, just rebalancing, I think, is going to potentially create a bit of flow. Certainly you've seen that in fund flows as well, a lot of outflows from equities. So, and the typical pattern is that after election, you tend to see flows back in. And also just with treasury yields, sort of another indicator is that the last four elections, you've seen treasury yields just sort of meander around the lows up to the election. And then in the months afterwards, drift upwards. So, and, you know, very dramatically so in 2016. But so, yeah, I mean, and then just, you know, on the actual details, I think, you know, the short term is, you know, some capability of putting in a stimulus plan is going to be pretty important. With the Democrats, maybe you get more stimulus, more short-term sugar hit. But I think, you know, I think almost regardless of that, if you just clear the event risk off the table, then that by itself can be a bit of an upside catalyst. The counterpoint to that is obviously that you don't remove the event risk off the table, that you have a long, drawn-out, contested process, which...
Right.
Yeah.
Which we all hope doesn't happen, but in all honesty, we're kidding ourselves. It's going to be a shit show. hopefully it's not. I mean, hopefully it's just decisive either way, but yep. Just the way the states vote, sorry, the states count the votes means, because basically the Rust Belt, apart from Michigan, can't vote, count anything a day ahead. Michigan can do some stuff one day ahead, just one day ahead. Okay. Why on earth you wouldn't count votes ahead that have come in?
Yeah.
I have absolutely no idea. It's just, I mean, as a Brit or anyone in Europe or New Zealand or Aussie, like, this is just like nonsense. But the southern states, California, Georgia, North Carolina, Arizona, they do count in advance. They will have results on election day. So if it's a Biden landslide, we will know on election day because it means he's won Florida, North Carolina, that type of stuff. Then the Rust Belt's irrelevant. He's going to win. But if it's not, if Trump wins some of those, and most importantly, of course, Florida, this could easily go for several weeks. And there's troops on the ground already in Pennsylvania. Well, that's the most important swing state. Like, it's this has been a slow motion train wreck as well, but most people have just ignored. So a lot of people, I don't think investors have, but that could be the real reason people have risked off, because, like, to your point, if there's a decisive winner either way, risk will probably just rally. But, you know, if we still don't know in mid-December who's won, who knows?
Yep. Well, this time next week, we'll know.
That's what I keep saying on Twitter. Now people are like, oh my God, you're like so boring saying that. I'm like, well, because the only way I can ever end with someone that I disagree with on Twitter is you've either got to make a joke or just stop. There's no point just trolling. Yeah. It's never going to go anywhere.
Nah.
The other way I just say, well, look, we're finding out in 7 days or 5 days. And you know what? We'll find out. Maybe. And you know what?
Yeah.
People will be triumphant and lots of people will be very much not. But
On Twitter, I never get in, well, I try not, I'll have discussions, but I never get into arguments because I just don't see the point of it. I always try to take the high road. Don't get drawn into those things. And just assume that everyone has the best intention, because it's very easy to, misguess people's intentions from a couple of words of text.
That's very true. I've tried to get better on this, but I must admit the election has, because Raoul says exactly the same thing, and he's very deplorable. Yeah. And he gets a lot of people throwing a lot of hate at him too. I think you're at the kind of 50,000 follower level where, I think it was Tracy Shuchart told me, that's when all the psychos start coming. But then when you get into the six figures within FinTwit, then you literally have not just the psychos from FinTwit, but from elsewhere too. So I don't get that yet. It's just like...
No, neither. But I kind of value it to a certain extent, because, you know, there's been a couple of times where, you know, at sort of key inflection points where I'd put up a chart and say, you know, I think it was with the bottom in bond yields last year, I said, you know, bonds are way overvalued. And then I got, you know, the abuse meter really started lighting up. And, I kind of joke about it as the abuse meter, the higher the abuse meter goes, the the more conviction I have in that view.
Right.
Can actually be a useful sort of sentiment indicator in a way.
Right. It also, like, 1 in 5 or 1 in 10 times or whatever the number is.
Yep.
Someone will actually have done their work and will, you know, because so often I'll say, hey, well, what's your analysis? Like, why do you think that? Versus, you know, not.
And oh, yeah.
Please put the detail in. I'm really interested in
those. Those are different. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And then, of course, exactly. 19 times out of 20, you're going to get crickets back. No one's going to say anything. But now and again, someone comes back with, well, here's what I'm thinking. Like, holy shit. Like, actually, that's really good thinking. Absolutely. That can
change. Oh, yeah. Definitely.
So I think it's absolutely worth it for those moments. Yeah, no, if it's just a troll fest, it's probably not going to do that.
Yeah.
Well, Callum, look, we've covered a hell of a lot. And, how can people find out more about you? Well, obviously, Twitter.
Yep.
But yeah.
Just go to Twitter and start from there. Man, I've got my LinkedIn on there, and I think my pinned tweet is the website, and so topdowncharts.com and at topdowncharts on Twitter as well. So.
And if people are interested in your research, then are there like samples on the website and stuff like that? Or
Yeah, they generally request a trial and go from there. Yep.
Cool. Very good. Good stuff. Well, let's hope we're all surviving this time next week. We'll be okay in Hong Kong and New Zealand. So.
Yep.
But to everyone in America listening, please vote if you want to. And actually, someone had a go at me once for saying that. They said, well, I don't want to vote. I'm like, okay, well, don't vote then. But if you want to vote,
please vote or not, minute. Or whatever.
Yeah, you know, that's how you have to tweet these days. Well, you know, 5 caveats and everything.
Exactly, yeah.
But yeah, if you want to vote and you want to use the mail system, don't leave it to the last minute if you want your vote to count. You know, if you want to vote and you want to turn up in person, that's absolutely fine. Just be aware there might be a big queue. So, you know. All right, good stuff. Well, let's leave it there. Thanks a lot, Callum. And
it's a pleasure.
We'll see you on Twitter.